is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Steve Moore, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Everyday guys to me are, you're going to have great days, you're going to have bad days, you're going to have days in between, but that doesn't change how you are.
Pat Baldwin just completed his third season as the head coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. In his first season on the bench, he led the Panthers to 16 victories, an improvement of 5 wins over the prior season, while also finishing 4 spots higher in the final Horizon League regular season standings. A key member of the Northwestern coaching staff under head coach Chris Collins, Baldwin spent 4 seasons as an assistant coach at Northwestern, helping rebuild his alma mater into a force in the Big Ten. Pat got his coaching start at Division II Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, during the 2001-2002 season. From there, he coached at UW-Green Bay, Loyola of Chicago, and Missouri State before returning to Northwestern. After graduating from Northwestern, Baldwin spent 3 years as a business analyst at Dean Foods in Rosemont, Illinois, before playing professional basketball in Bosnia and Croatia from 1999 to 2001. Baldwin was a standout player for Northwestern from 1990 to 1994. He ranks first in school history with 272 career steals, is second all-time with 452 assists, and 20th with 1,189 points. After you're finished listening to the show, hop over to iTunes and leave us a 5-star rating and review to help others in the basketball community find the Hoopheads podcast. If you haven't told a friend or coaching colleague about the show, what are you waiting for? Tell them to subscribe now on their favorite podcast app so they never miss an episode. You can find all the show notes plus every episode we've ever recorded on our website, hoopheadspod.com. Get your notebook and grab a pen so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach Pat Baldwin from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here this morning without my co-host Jason Sunkel, but I am here with Coach Pat Baldwin from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Pat, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on.
We are excited to have you on, dig into all the things that you've been able to do in the game, both as a player and as a coach, and I want to go back in time to when you were a kid and just talk a little bit about how you fell in love with the game of basketball when you were younger.
You know, that was... seems like a long time ago, but
I can relate to that.
You know, when I was a kid, I was pretty fortunate to have, I was the youngest of 7 in my family. So, you know, I had 3 brothers and 3 sisters and they were all in the game and all very active and just sports in general. And in our town, you know, our high school team and kids, we had kids all around our neighborhood. I had a park too, you know, 2 blocks away from me. And, you know, so that was pretty easy to fall in love with the game. And, you know, so from the time I can remember, I had a ball in my hand. You know, my gym teacher at the time, Bob Strano, he since had passed away. He had a picture of me at on a playground, you know, with 3 balls in my hand, not sharing with anybody. So that kind of, you know, that picture kind of summarized what either any type of ball meant to me, but particularly basketball. And so, you know, I got involved at an early age and just playing, watching my brothers and sisters play. You know, my sister was a really good, my oldest sister was a really good basketball player. She played multiple sports. And, you know, she, you know, watching her, you know, a lot of it, you know, drew me to the game. And then, you know, one of my brothers, my second oldest brother, he played on the high school team and he was probably the most athletic out of all of us. He had 4.240 speed and had some tryouts with the Royals and all of that. But he also played, and I used to just love, when I was little, just going to his practices, going to the high school games. I can remember and recall when I was, you know, I would stand underneath the basket during layup lines, and I could just feel the guys when they did their layups, just the wind passing by me, you know, just how quick they were. Yeah, I always thought about those little times when I little things when I grew up, and how enthralled I was. And so, you know, fast forwarding a little bit into, you know, when I got to, you know, probably third grade, it just became an obsession with me. Where I had to be at the gym. I couldn't miss any games. You know, I wanted to be in every single play. My brother, Dwayne, he would tell you that there was a time that 50 points was kind of the point total you wanted to get in the middle school games that we played on Saturdays at Nettie Hartman. And there was a time that, you know, we were getting close. We were kind of like at 45 points. Then we scored 46, and then we scored 48. And then someone missed a free throw. We got to 49 points, and the coach told us to hold the ball. So after that, and I just was crying on the bench. I went home. I was crying. You couldn't console me. You know, I wanted to get that benchmark of 50 points, you know, for our team. And maybe it was a lesson by the coach just to be humble and have some humility. But that was great. And then, you know, I think the trajectory of my basketball career kind of changed in fifth grade when I started playing AAU. A very good teammate of mine and friend of mine to this day, Todd Knoll, his family was playing, you know, someone had introduced AAU to him. And at that time, it was really statewide AAU. It wasn't the national thing that we know now. And then you go to the nationals in different parts. And, you know, so I was introduced at fifth grade to AAU basketball. And, you know, the team was out of Atchison, Kansas. George Ross was the head coach. And I just thought it was tremendous, just the opportunity to get a chance to play and travel a little bit. My first travel AAU game was in Des Moines, Iowa. You know, and I'm from Kansas City, so playing in Des Moines, Iowa for the Nationals, and we played a team out of Potomac Valley in Maryland, and there were a number of teams that we played, but I remember that game specifically because it introduced me to big time basketball, in my opinion, at that age, because they were pressing us, they were trapping us, they were getting layups and steals. So you know, that made me, you know, really hungry to get better. And then my high school team was good. You know, we went on my junior high school team. We only lost two games in my 3 years in junior high. They didn't have ninth grade at the high school that time. We were seventh through ninth. We were pretty good. Went undefeated my freshman year. And then going into the high school was really fun, because all the years of watching my brothers and sisters play and participate and doing all that stuff, it was just a dream come true to be able to play high school basketball for my high school and wear the blue and white and be a pioneer. It's nostalgic even talking about it today. You know, I'm getting goosebumps.
Yeah, that's awesome. There's two things I wanted to ask you about here. So one is what you just described, I think, is such a huge part of having a successful high school program. And that is, you know, I heard you start from the time that you were a little kid early in elementary school, and clearly you had siblings that were on the team. But regardless, I think that when you can set up that aspirational situation where kids who are 7, 8, 9 years old are coming to those high school games and looking at those kids who are on that team and saying, man, I can't wait till one day I get to put that jersey on, or I can't wait until one day I get to play for that coach, or I can't wait till one day that I can run out of the tunnel and hear the fight song. To me, that's such a huge part of building a high school program. And so it's, again, I feel the same way. Like, my experience was very similar to yours from a standpoint of when I was in elementary school. I remember, I tell people this all the time, the one thing that I always thought was the coolest thing was to watch the high school kids come out and slap the backboard on their layups during warmups. Like, I thought that was like the greatest thing. Man, I cannot wait until I can go out there in warmups and just slap the glass on this in this layup line. And so it was funny when you said, you know, you could feel the wind of the players, you know, coming past you when you're standing underneath the basket. I can completely, completely relate to that. So that's one piece of it. And the second thing I wanted to ask you about is, you know, you talked about when you were little and obviously with lots of brothers and sisters and you're playing and you're outside doing all those things. Were you at any point a multi-sport athlete during high school, or at what point did you kind of drop those other sports if you did and just focus on basketball?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. You know, I go back to, you know, what my dad would always say to all of us is, you know, he would always tell me not to put all your eggs in one basket. And he was talking about, you know, sports and all of that stuff. And, you know, I played baseball, I played football. My dad would always say, quiet is kept. He's pretty a good soccer player too. You know, played soccer when I was younger and was on a travel soccer team as a goalie. So, you know, I played all the sports and wanted to do every single one of them. I loved Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders and those guys who played multiple sports as well. And you know, so my dad always wanted me to keep my options open, you know, with that stuff. And going into high school, I didn't think about, you know, honestly, I didn't think about specializing in one thing or another. The seasons, when the seasons change, that means that you're in a different sport. That's what I thought about. So, but with AAU, I started playing AAU a lot, even more, and it became, you know, much bigger as I got into high school. And with spring was usually baseball for me. And I found myself missing baseball for AAU tournaments. And that was really a conflict for me because I loved baseball. I loved, you know, pitching and catching and doing all that stuff and hitting and being a part of that. And then when I got to my junior year, and I was still playing football at the time as well as a quarterback, when I got to my junior year, you know, I had an injury towards the tail end of my junior year in football. It wasn't huge, but it was something that scared me. And my passion was with basketball because I grew up you know, you can do basketball at any point, whether it was outside, inside. We were able to get to the gyms. I used to go to watch my dad referee and do all that stuff. So you could play it at any time of the year. Baseball was tough to do that. Football was tough to do that unless you just threw the football inside. So I had a passion for basketball. And when I had that injury you know, that really kind of made me think that was something that I truly love, that I wanted to just do that and not get hurt. And you know, so that was kind of after my junior year, you know, I just concentrated on basketball and because, you know, in the spring and, you know, basketball just consumed everything that I did, from time to my mind to all of that.
At what point in your playing career in high school did you start thinking about playing college basketball? Was that something that was always on your mind from the time you were younger? Was it something that snuck up on you? Just describe a little bit about how you got to the point where you thought, hey, I'm going to have a chance to play college basketball. And then we can talk a little bit about your recruiting process and what that was like for you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because kids nowadays just talk about hooping. You know, all I care about is just hooping. And that's what I thought about. I had brothers, my brothers and sisters, they went to college, and my oldest sister went on to you know, she played three sports in college. I didn't think about college in the sense of going there to play. I loved watching the game. I remember watching a lot of the NCAA tournament and the high school state tournament and all that stuff. And my dad used to always take me to the NAIA tournament in Kansas City, which was great because he got me out of school to be able to do that with
double perks. Double perks, man.
Absolutely. But, you know, it really snuck up on me because I had a pretty good summer after my junior year. So I had, you know, going into my senior year, I had a pretty good summer. And then I started getting mail. Then I started getting phone calls. And the crazy thing is at these AAU tournaments, coaches were in the lobbies of the hotels we were at. So then you start thinking like something's going on. And I had pretty good teammates as well in AAU. You know, I had guys that ended up going to KU and Missouri and some really good schools playing basketball. And so then it really it caught me at that point. And again, I was just still hooping and playing and loving the game and not thinking of it as, man, now you need to get serious about where you want to go and what you want to do from that standpoint. Because I just thought high school would go on forever from that standpoint and never thought about it, you know, time eclipsing.
Was there somebody that helped you through that recruiting process, high school coach, your parents, AAU coach? Because I know at that time, there just wasn't, you know, you think about the amount of information now that's available to kids just in terms of the internet and just being able to talk to people. And I think that high school coaches and AAU coaches are a lot more well-versed on just what goes on in terms of recruiting today. But I think back in the era when you and I were coming up, it wasn't as prevalent. So do you remember, who'd you get advice from? Or do you remember trying to navigate the process and what that was like?
You know, to be honest with you, and it's crazy that a lot of people would say that I was wise beyond my years. And I was really quiet about the entire process. I loved it. You know, my high school coach was really good about it, you know, because he had coached guys that had played at Kansas and, you know, guys that had gone to, you know, different junior college programs. So he understood the recruiting process. And my brothers and sisters were recruited, but probably for me, too young to really even care at that point what was going on. But my high school coach, when I was going through everything, he was always in my ear. He was always talking to me about the things that you need to work on. And he would always tell me, and my mom would say the same thing, is, you know, things happen for a reason. Your time is going to come. And I think he just let me enjoy the process more than anything and just fielded all the stuff and shielded me from, you know, all the recruiting stuff as well. And so if a coach came in to see me, he wouldn't even tell me that a coach was coming in to see me. He just expected me and kind of knew my personality that I would work hard no matter what. But my high school coach, Larry Hogan, was really essential in helping me through this process. And, you know, I had some schools recruiting me during the fall. Right now, kids are committing, you know, before their junior year sometimes, or before their senior year. And I waited until, you know, mid-January to commit. So so for me, he just made sure that I stayed humble, that I continued to work. And, you know, when it came down to, you know, decisions that I had to make and schools I had to look at, he was counseling me at that point.
So obviously you end up at Northwestern, but what was the decision-making process that landed you there as opposed to somewhere else? Do you remember who your final couple schools were and then ultimately what pushed the decision over the top to make it Northwestern?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is when I was at Five Star Basketball Camp, I went there for 2 out of 3 years in my high school career in Pennsylvania. And, you know, at that point, all the best would go there if it's not Nike, the Nike camp at that time. But a lot of really good players would go there. I remember being at the camp and Grant Hill was there, Sean Bradley, you know, a lot of really good players doing that were my age that were at that camp. So the reason why I'm bringing that camp up is there was one of the counselors was Ramil Robinson from Michigan. And I could just remember, I was like looking at him like, man, his body, you know, he's about my size, about 6'2". He was strong. He was physical. And I, you know, and then ultimately I saw him in the NCAA tournament and in the Final Four and the championship game and making those free throws.
Yep.
Yeah, against Seton Hall. And so when I started thinking about college basketball and not necessarily programs, I started thinking about leagues. What league is he in? He's in the Big Ten. And I was a physical guard, and a lot of people were telling me about the Big Ten and how physical it was, and seeing the Michigans and the Illini and, you know, all those schools, obviously Indiana, seeing those schools, it was an extremely physical league. And I just said, you know what, that fits who I was at the time. And you know, so the Big Eight was right. I lived about 20 minutes from KU. So, you know, they were recruiting me. Missouri was recruiting me. They were in the Big 8 at that time, now the Big 12. And, you know, so that kind of was the list of schools that I had. But the Big 10 was what really intrigued me. And then the other side of that was, you know, when Northwestern came in, my dad started talking to me about life after basketball and what that would mean for me. You know, but I was telling him, like, Dad, hold on. I'm thinking about winning. I'm thinking about Kansas and Missouri, and UConn was recruiting me at the time as well. Those were kind of the last four. And he was like, son, he said, don't worry about all that stuff. And then my mindset started getting to the point where I was thinking, I've always had a chip on my shoulder, and I still do to this day. And so at that point I started thinking, you know what, Northwestern hadn't done much. They hadn't won. You know, they had a really good player in Rex Walters and some other good guys I thought I could come in and be a part of. And I just said, you know what, I want to be part of that first group that took this team, you know, someplace that won there. And I wanted my name to be a part of history from that standpoint. And so that's what got me to Northwestern in addition to the academic part of it that really paved my way for my future.
Yeah, I'm sure your dad had some conversations with you about the academics at Northwestern at some point.
Yeah, absolutely, he did.
All right, so what did the summer look like between your senior year of high school and your freshman year at Northwestern for you in terms of getting yourself prepared? What do you remember about that summer? And then what was your biggest adjustment going into college, both from a social academic standpoint and then basketball wise?
Yeah, you know, I thought, you know, my summer going, or the spring summer going into, you know, before my freshman year, I was maniacal about my workouts and what I did. So there were some all-star games in between there. Also, our senior group, which was pretty good. I told you we had some guys that from my AAU team, they played for Kansas and Missouri and some other programs. You know, we played against, at that point, it was the Soviet Union in an all-star game at Kemper Arena in Kansas City where the Kings used to play. So that was the highlight of my summer. But I was maniacal in my workouts. You know, I lifted so much in preparation. I ran, I did all of that stuff knowing that, you know, I would have an opportunity to, you know, to play and hopefully make a difference. And the biggest, so that wasn't going to be, the basketball side wasn't going to be the greatest challenge for me. The social and the academic side was going to be the greatest challenge. As much as I thought that I was smart, I found out there were people like 20 times, 30 times smarter than I was. So that was a huge adjustment to me in the competition in the classroom as well. The social aspect, all I cared about was basketball. You know, so there wasn't, for me, there wasn't a lot of going out and doing all that stuff. And I was almost socially awkward because it was basketball and sports. And that's what I lived. That's what my life was. And I had my friends in college and all that stuff and still had some good times with them. But I wasn't used to, hey, you have two or three classes a day, your workouts, and then you have some social time. I wasn't used to that. So the biggest thing was the social and academic transition for me, which was the most difficult part and adjusting to that. But the basketball, you know, I was ready to go, and it actually hurt me as far as getting too big. And cause I had gone from shooting about 45% from the three in high school and really struggling to shoot the basketball and finding my rhythm. My first year, even though I started every single game.
Yeah, I think that it speaks a lot in terms of when you talk about that adjustment period from a social standpoint. And I think a lot of guys are similar to you in that, you know, you have this sort of maniacal focus on basketball. And I think when you're in your sort of high school bubble, you can do that. And your family obviously supports that. And then you get to the case where, you know, you're in college and sort of that freedom opens up and you kind of got to figure it out. And there's an adjustment for everybody when you get through that. And it sounds like from a basketball standpoint, you were obviously clearly ready to go right from the get-go. So when you think about your career at Northwestern, give me a couple things. One, give me a highlight or two that stands out for you. And then obviously you played against some tremendous players, some players that have gone on to become rather famous and were famous while they were in their school. So talk a little bit about just the best guy or two, or three that you played against, and give us some highlights of some things that you remember specifically about your career at Northwestern.
Yeah, I could go on for days talking about the best guys.
I'm sure. That's a long list. You want to give me the top 25?
Yeah, I'll do that. We'll do that. You know, first of all, the highlight was my first Big Ten game. And yeah, there were some non-conference games that we played and was able to do that. But my first Big Ten game was against Purdue. And, you know, at the time, you know, they had Scheffler. I don't know if you remember him. He was a big lefty.
Big Steve Scheffler. Absolutely.
Yeah, he was 6'9 and probably 900 pounds, but built like granite. And then, you know, they had Woody Austin. They had some really good players, and that was my first Big Ten game against an elite program or very good program that was built on toughness and all of that. So that was a highlight, the first Big Ten game. And then, you know, the last highlight or the second highlight that was good that I remember to this day was my last game, regular season game as a senior in college. And Michigan came in. That was our last game. I think it was March 3rd or something like that. They had come in and they didn't have Chris Webber at the time. He had already declared for the NBA draft. But they had Juwan Howard. They had Jalen Rose. And then they had Jimmy King and Ray Jackson still. And they needed that game to win the Big Ten outright. And we needed that game to give us any hope of playing in any sort of tournament. So, you know, it was the NCAA tournament or NIT. There wasn't a CBI, CSI, and all of that stuff. So we ended up playing them to overtime and then eventually beating them in overtime. And I think I had 20 and 9 or 10 in that game and played really well and kind of cemented, kind of closed a chapter from us from that standpoint of my Big Ten career playing against Michigan. And so those two were the greatest highlights for me from a basketball standpoint. And then if I start thinking about the greatest players that I played against, three guys really stand out to me. One was Jim Jackson. You know, he was 6'6", 6'7", really tough, strong, and he played the point guard position. But he could play all over the court. But so just so tough and strong. I'll give you a fourth one too. And then Steve Smith at Michigan State at 6'8", he played the point for them and was really good. And then the last two, you know, Calvert Chaney, I'll tell you a story about guarding Calvert Chaney. So we're going into Indiana. He was however many points from, you know, becoming the all-time leading scorer in Indiana history. And so Coach Foster, Bill Foster, came to me and he said, "All right, we're going to play a box and one." And I was like, "Okay, good." And I said, "So who's guarding Calvert?" So he said, "You are."
Nice. There you go.
So then I get there, and I'm not afraid of anybody. So I get there, and I find out that he has to get to a certain number of points. I think it was 35 or 36 to get to his whatever the total was, the all-time scoring total was. They set every single screen imaginable for him to get open. I'm bouncing off these guys and getting screened left and right. He ended up getting it, and I talked to him about it to this day because he had been in the coaching profession for a little bit in college, and he was one of the hardest persons that I had to guard. And then the last one was Glenn Big Dog Robinson that played at Purdue. Just at 6'8", just could do so many different things, but just tough and athletic. And, you know, he beat us the first game of my senior year in the Big Ten on a back, kind of a behind the backboard shot, kind of like Bird did, but it didn't go over the top with three hands in his face. And that was the game winner to beat us by one. But I also played with him in the U.S. Olympic Festival going into my sophomore year. He was going into his freshman year. And it was great playing with him because made my job easier. Just pass it to the best coach.
No doubt about that. He's a guy who I think you look at his, you know, you look at his NBA career, and obviously he had a good NBA career. But I think if you'd have said coming out of college what he was going to be in the pros, I think he probably didn't achieve the heights that maybe he expected. I think that other people expected when you thought about how dominant he was as a college, you know, as a college player at Purdue. He was just, I mean, he was incredible.
Oh, he was unbelievable. And he had a stretch where when he was playing against Kansas, you know, he had a big time game against them and dunked on Greg Ostertag. Ostertag gave him five. I know some of Ostertag's teammates at this point were sick to death when he gave Big Dog five after that dunk on him. And then Duke, he played against Grant Hill in that Elite Eight. That was a great game as well. But he was a tremendous player.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I have two good stories for you related to two of the four guys that you talked about. So Jimmy Jackson's an Ohio guy. Yeah. And when I was in high school, my dad and I went to a local high school here that Jimmy Jackson's team with Toledo McCumber came into and played here close to us, probably about a half hour away. And so I had never seen Jimmy Jackson, just had heard, you know, you hear the stories, but you had never seen him. And he was in 10th grade at the time. And my dad and I went, you know, you're just in a little high school gym and, you know, we got there early and you're sitting in the bleachers watching the JV game. And, you know, you're wondering, all right, are we going to be able to know who this guy is? You know, when he comes out, you know, let's try to identify, you know, we didn't have the roster. And so, you know, he comes running out and clearly, obviously, immediately, you know, you see, you're like, yeah, I think we know which one Jimmy Jackson is, because he was built the way he was as an NBA player. He was built that way when he was a 10th grader in high school. I mean, he just was, again, it was like watching a man playing among boys. So I was always a fan of him just because I kind of got on him early and knew a little bit about him back in those days. And then my Steve Smith story. So when I was at Kent my freshman year, which was 88-89, I didn't play very much that year. But played a little bit, but we made it to the NIT and we played against Michigan State. So that was the year Steve Smith was a sophomore. And so we kind of had a bench crew at the end of our bench. Our freshman class that year had seven kids. And so there was one who played a lot. And then there was a couple that myself, another guy that played, I don't know, we might've played 6 or 8 minutes a game, something like that. But my one teammate went in the last, we lost that game, and he checked in the last, I don't know, we maybe went in the last minute and a half or so. And for some reason, Steve Smith was still in the game. But my friend was guarding Steve Smith and was picking him up like at half court. And Smith threw the Smitty move at him, the half, you know, the half reverse. And my friend fell down. And and so for the remainder of his career, that was continuously brought up, that Steve Smith made him fall down with what ended up being obviously his signature move. If you anybody out there, if you search Steve Smith highlights, you're going to see 40 of those little hesitation reverse, you know, fake reverse pivot moves. That was his move. And man, that guy was good. He was a very, 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 very good player. So, all right, let's go to, obviously you want to keep playing when you get done. So talk about when you started thinking about playing professional basketball, what the process was like, and then we could talk a little bit about your experiences overseas.
Yeah, you know, when I graduated and, you know, my career was over at Northwestern from a basketball standpoint, I started working out and doing all that stuff, and it was probably a long shot at that point for the NBA, although, you know, I still was thinking about it. I mean, who wouldn't? And you know, so I get an agent, I go through that process. And I think like a lot of kids, and maybe I was just so naive, I'm sitting watching a draft and the 0.00001% that my name is called, you know?
Oh yeah.
So after that, you know, I, you know, my agent and I would talk, and then I go through the summer and work out and was in LA for the summer league. And at that point it was, you know, there was going to be a lockout, you know, prior to that season being over in the NBA. So, you know, there were some guys that were playing in that, you know, had been in the NBA, but now still trying to get back in. So, you know, they were in the LA Summer League and I played and it was good. And then I had after that, was able to get to the CBA, at the time it was called the Hartford Hellcats. And then, they changed to the Connecticut Pride. Paul Mokeski was the coach. So that was a short stint and, you know, came back after that and, worked for a little bit, came back to Kansas, but worked for a little bit, worked at Converse, did all that stuff because I knew I still wanted to play. So I didn't want to get a job that kind of restricted me from being able to just break off and do what I wanted to do. And so after that, I continued to work. And then there was this developmental league. I don't know if it was probably the worst league I've ever joined. But I went down to Augusta, Georgia. There were some good players in it, though. The team was called Augusta Drive. I think it was called the ABL, American Basketball League. And so I was in Augusta. We played teams from North Carolina and Alabama and, some really talented players. I even had teammates that I competed against in the Big Ten on the team. A couple guys that were from Arkansas at the time were on that team. So it was kind of a good concept, but just didn't have the money in order to survive. So the league folded. I said, I'm tired of the rat race at that point. And, you know, I had a couple of nagging injuries and then just decided to work for 3 years. You know, I got a job at Dean Foods Company in Chicago first as assistant marketing manager, then as a business analyst, and did that for 3 years, but I still had the bug to play. There was a gym right next door to, that was probably the worst thing that ever happened to the company, is there being a gym right next door, because, you know, I would get all my work done, what I needed to do, calls and formulas and all that stuff I needed to complete prior to midday. I would
Where's Pat?
I would skip lunch. I would skip lunch in order to just to play and lift and do all that stuff. And because I had gained a few pounds, but because of that gym, I had knocked off. You know, I got back to playing weight, and I was just there all the time. And after work, you know, I was there for about an hour, then would drive home so got back in shape. And then there was an opportunity in Elmhurst. There was a camp for guys that wanted to try to see if they can get overseas. So there was a lot of international representatives, from general managers to scouts and all of that stuff. And, you know, I was MVP of this camp. And from that point, got on to, it was a team called Erne Brotnjo in Bosnia and Herzegovina, it's right on the border of Croatia. So I ended up signing with them, which was amazing. I didn't know what to expect. And obviously I think everybody knows about what was going on in the war at that point in that area. And I almost didn't care. Just get me over there, let me play, let me get a feel for it. And they assured me that there were no issues anymore. And so I had a great year there. And then, you know, the following year went to Zadar in Croatia, you know, where Dino Raja played and, you know, some really big time players. And he was from there where they played. It was the greatest experience of my life from a basketball standpoint. I mean, I can talk about all the high school and college stuff, but when you start putting things in perspective and what playing in Europe and playing in that town, and for me, kind of historical perspectives, that was the greatest, greatest place and time of my life. My wife and I absolutely enjoyed it. We totally immersed ourselves in their culture. I learned the language a little bit. I'm not going to sit here and tell you I know the language, but, you know, learned the language. Just still have friends to this day from that time and still communicate with them. If my knees and everything else held up, I still would have been there. But I stopped playing too because of 9/11. You know, so that I had a contract to sign in Italy the following year. But 9/11 hit in that September, I believe, obviously, and decided not to put my family or my wife's family through that.
Yeah, that was a tough decision, I'm sure, to make, especially sounds like with the great experience that you had
to, you know, to be able to shut that down and not go back. So I have to ask you, which I ask to anybody who's played overseas, you have to have, everybody has a crazy European overseas basketball story. So what's the, what's the craziest story that you can tell on air, for the time that you were over there? Cause everybody, everybody has one.
Well, this is a really funny one. Hopefully no one from Bosnia is listening, but the owner for that team was, it was reported that he had stolen money from banks and was this big time mafia guy. And I had no idea, but it was reported. And so the whole time I'm just, let me just do my job. And if he needed me to score 20, I'm scoring 20. Cause that was the funny thing is I love the pass and give up the ball. And then my coach came to me and the owner was, he, the coach was, you know, he was talking English while the owner was talking in Croatian. And all I heard my coach say was, Patrick, we didn't bring you here to pass. We bring you here to score. And I said, that's all I needed to know. So, so I, you know, I went in and started, you know, started scoring and that was my job, you know, got MVPs in some of these tournaments that we were doing there. But as the story goes, so I started knowing that about the owner and even the players started saying that, that he even shot his cousin, you know, over some money. And the funny thing,
you better be scoring then.
Absolutely. So his cousin even still worked for him at that time after he was shot. So, so he had a boat. He had a boat along the Adriatic Sea and all that stuff. And there was one weekend that he asked my wife and I to go out on the boat with him. And so, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, there is absolutely no way that I'm going on this boat with this.
You better have a big game right before you go, right? Don't score 2 points the game before you go.
Exactly. Because I don't know what his intentions are, what he's going to do to me and all that stuff. And I respectfully declined. And, you know, who knows, who knows what would happen if I'd have gone on that boat. So that was kind of the crazy story.
That's good. That's a good point. That's a good one, man. I love it. Everybody has one that are, they're just, it's amazing just how kind of goofy situations can be over there for sure.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoop Heads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
So all this being said and going through your playing career and everything, at no point during this discussion have we talked at all about coaching. So you, it seems like you were focused on continuing to be a player. And had you thought about coaching at any point while you were playing, or was it now here you get done and you're looking around, you're like, yeah, I don't know if I want to go back to the business world. I want to stay involved in the game. Let's give coaching a try. Or was coaching kind of always in the back of your head? Just explain how you came to the coaching profession after your playing career ended.
Well, I'll tell you this, that when I was in high school, I thought about coaching. One of my favorite coaches to watch was John Thompson at Georgetown. I always loved their team. I even wanted to go to Georgetown. I'll tell you a funny story about that. You know, I'm being recruited and only place at the point at the time I wanted to go to is Georgetown. So I come home from school and my mom tells me I got a letter from Georgetown. As soon as she said I was at the door, I sprinted from the front door to where she kept the mail. I opened it up. I'm so excited. I'm thinking I'm getting something from John Thompson. It ended up being an admissions letter. So, you know, so I'm so disappointed. And to this point, I hate Georgetown because of that.
That's funny.
But the funny thing is when I, you know, I told you about my time at Dean Foods, I liked working in the business world and doing all that stuff. I didn't love it. You know, I didn't have the passion for it that I do for basketball and sports. And so in talking to my wife, you know, the thing that she taught, just do something that you love to do. And I just felt from that point in talking with her that after I'm done playing, that I'm going to try to find something in coaching. So that was my plan from once I played, getting that out of my system. And then once I was done, to go into coaching and trying to be the best coach I could be.
So when you first get into coaching, you get your first job as an assistant at Lincoln. What's your first introduction to coaching like? What do you remember about it? What was something that maybe surprised you about coaching that you didn't realize when you were on the playing side of it?
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, so after 9/11 hit, I had to think right away, I'm not going back over there to play. So I'm scrambling now and trying to, and we saved a little bit of money and stuff like that. But so I'm trying to figure out what I needed to do and what I wanted to do. And so Bill Pope, who's now a scout with the Kings, you know, he was the head coach at Lincoln. So I get over there, talk with him. You know, he convinces me that this is an opportunity to get started. And it was a Division II job. So the first thing that kind of woke me up to college basketball and first memories was I'm doing everything, you know, and I'm doing the laundry, I'm handling some academic stuff, I'm doing recruiting, I'm sweeping the floors, I'm doing drills, I'm on the phone, you know, so I was like, you know, what CEOs talk about, you better understand every single part about this business or else you'll fail. So, you know, that was the thing that I remember just doing everything. And I didn't think about, was this a problem? I just think about, this is what's expected and this is what I should do and what I wanted to do. So that was the kind of the first introduction that this is more than full time. You know, it's a 24/7 deal, you know, from start to finish.
Did you realize that as a player? I mean, did you think, if you think back to, let's just go with your time at Northwestern, did you think about your coaches at that time having to do all those administrative and other things that were that weren't related to basketball? Because I think of myself as a player and I think back to my time in college and I really, you know, again, coaches show up at practice, they're at the games, they're on the bus, but you don't think about all the time that they're putting in with all these non-basketball related activities. And that was the thing that once you get into coaching that I think you don't appreciate as a player, the amount of time that your coaches put in outside of the time on the practice floor and at the actual games.
I had no idea, you know, when I was playing at Northwestern and all the things the head coach and the assistant coach did, I had no idea what they had gone through and the knuckleheads they had to deal with, like me, you know, coming through. So I mean, it was an eye-opening experience, but it wasn't something that I was afraid of, because I've always felt that I had a tremendous work ethic and whatever it is, whether it was playing, whether it was school, all that stuff. I just wanted to do my job and do it to the best of my ability. But when I found out that this is what it takes, I was like, God bless every single one of these coaches that coach out there, because, you know, there's so much of a commitment to it from the things that happen with being away from your family, about, you know, all the little things that you don't see, you know, dealing with, you know, some of these student athletes and sometimes what they go through, the media, all that stuff you don't recognize and you don't see as a player, and you just see the surface stuff. But when you definitely dive and get underneath the surface of everything, there's so much in this world that would blow people away.
Yeah, no question about that. Let's talk. I know I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but I think you just brought it up and I think it's a relevant question that coaches out there, I think all coaches, I don't know if struggle with this is the right word, but have to figure out. And you talked a little bit about your family, and I know you have four kids and a wife, and you're obviously running the head of a Division I program. So talk a little bit about how you tried to strike a balance between your ambition as it relates to being a basketball coach and what your responsibilities are and what you want to be able to do at home with your family. Just talk a little bit about how you handle that particular part of the job.
You know, I think it's, you know, in the very beginning, it's difficult. And I'll say this, anybody who gets their first opportunity as a head coach, you think about the number one thing that you think about is, how can I be successful in this place that I'm at? Because I don't know if I'll get another chance. So that's one of the first things that you think about. And if you're worth anything, or if you really are conscious about that stuff, you try to do everything within your power to make sure you do everything right. So, and you want to win. You want to win. So you're going to exhaust yourself. You know, so the things that I'm sure other head coaches or guys in my position have done is that first or second, that those first 2 years, you're just running nonstop. You're constantly at the office. You're constantly on the phone. You're constantly thinking about your program. And unfortunately, at some point, you know, and it's not something that's conscious. It's unconscious. You do this is sometimes you forget about the most important people and things in your life. And a lot of that is your family, because of all the sacrifices you're trying to make for your program, you know, you sacrifice your family a lot. And, you know, that's the hardest thing that you go through as a head coach. And hopefully you have an extremely supportive family that when you're going through that grind and you're trying to do well, and you're going to have ups and downs. And even on my worst nights, I think my kids, they run for the hills after a loss or something like that, you know, because they know I'm not in a bad mood, but they also know how much I put into it, that you just hope that they have so much strength and resilience to be able to withstand all the pressures that come with it and the time away and all that stuff, because it's tough. And but I think as you start getting established, I'm going into my fourth year. And so I think what you start doing is you start really putting things in a greater perspective and what really matters. You know, hopefully you have your program where it's almost, it's never going to be running itself, but you hope you're in a situation where things are balanced and you know that certain people that you can trust within your team, they're taking care of that for you, and you're delegating the right things into the right people. And so now you can step back and you can concentrate doing a little bit more, you know, with your family. And I think if I'm just looking at our profession, this was a blessing in disguise. Not that I want anybody to die or have coronavirus, but this was a blessing in disguise to make all of us as coaches realize what's really important in our lives and in this world.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Pat. And that's one of the things that when I've talked to just my friends in my normal life and then other people that we've had on the podcast since this thing has kind of started, I think most of us who are trying to take that perspective that you just shared, which is it's a chance to step back and reevaluate where your priorities are. It's a chance to step back and look at what your life is. It's a chance, even more importantly, probably to spend more time with your family than anybody has, you know, any right to expect to be able to spend when you're in your day-to-day job and everything else. It just becomes such a challenge to carve out time when you're, again, when you're ambitious and you have things that you want to, when you want to achieve in your job, whether you're a coach or whether you're not a coach. You know, if you're an ambitious person, you tend to focus on those types of things. And sometimes, as you said, you get caught up and you forget about where the really important things are, which is, you know, which is at home, which is why, again, we all do the things we do because we love them and we're passionate about them. But we also do them with the idea in the back of our head that we're there to be able to support and raise our family. And that's really what it's all about. And I think you're right that, you know, again, it has been a blessing in that way, that it's slowed people down and caused them to sort of reevaluate themselves. And hopefully when we come out of this, eventually that change in perspective will continue to stick with us so that we can continue to make good decisions and be able to, you know, be able to strike that balance And so when I think about what you just said, one of the things that I heard you talk about there was, you know, getting the program where, not where it's running itself, but where you have the right people in place and you've been able to establish things now and you're in your fourth year and you have things, again, under control, maybe the right, maybe the wrong word, but you kind of have a system. Your systems are in place. You know what you want to do. You know how you want to do it. So if you think back to your time from starting out as an assistant to Lincoln, and then you went to a few other stops as an assistant coach, what are some of the things you learned along the way as an assistant coach that helped you when you eventually got the head job at UW-Milwaukee?
Well, you know, I think, one of the biggest things that I learned in all my time as an assistant coach and was trying to be the best assistant coach possible so our head coach didn't have to do as much. You know, I gradually picked all of that up. When I first started at Lincoln and then at Green Bay and then at Loyola, Missouri State and Northwestern, but when I first started out, I don't know if I really had that down. And although my intentions were great, you know, I had, all I was really trying to do is cement myself and I was trying to make the head coach happy, but I was in a little bit of a way, I was selfish in the way that I was thinking. And that wasn't a great thing. And I quickly, you know, had the perspective and changed that, and selfish in the way that I wanted to input, you know, I wanted to put my imprint and even as a player, I always wanted to, what can I do to help? But I became so selfish in that respect that sometimes it came off as either not listening or arrogant or something like that. And that was not my intention. But I got better, you know, after my, you know, third year of coaching. I mean, I learned to be even more, reliant on my other assistant coaches that were with me, and being a great teammate to the assistant coach, and then being a great steward for the head coach, and that was his program, and starting to think about, if I ran this program, how would I want this to be? So I started putting my mind into our head coach's mind, and stepping in his shoes a little bit, and you know, I think it became even better for me because I started becoming so much more unselfish in the respect of what I thought about. And it wasn't just about getting a guy that I liked. It was getting the guy that, you know, the coach, that the head coach wanted and liked and felt like he could win with. And this is what his thoughts were. And so as I look at myself as a head coach now, I'm very confident that I have guys on here that have been in the profession, you know, long enough that they know that, you know, there's certain things that I like and dislike, and they know how to fan those flames or put it out quickly before I have to get to it. So, you know, the delegation part of it is easy. I can relinquish some of the control. I am a control freak from that standpoint. I think a lot of head coaches are, but you just really have to have your coaches that are beside you that can help you with that, because you want everything to be right.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as the head coach, I think one of the hardest things, and I can speak to this just in my own life, whether it comes to coaching or it comes to a basketball camp business or a podcast or whatever, I tend to be a control freak and I tend to want things done a certain way. And then I think the danger, and it's kind of what you were alluding to, is the danger if you're not willing to delegate and put people in places that they can utilize their strengths and help you to, you know, get the things done that you need to get done. You end up in that situation we were talking about before, where you're just running around crazy trying to do everything, and then you're sacrificing a little bit of yourself, and you just can't get everything done if you can't delegate. And when you have good people that are part of your staff, you want to be able to take advantage of the things that they do well, and you want them to be able to help you. That's why they're there. And sometimes, again, as you said, it's difficult to do that because you want to have control. You want to be able to put your imprint. You believe in yourself and what you're capable of doing. And so I think that is, I'm sure, a process, and it sounds like it was a process for you. And I know it's an ongoing process for me, and probably for a lot of other coaches, is to be able to sort of surrender some of that authority, some of that control to someone else, to be able to say, hey, you got to take this part of it, or you're going to do this part of it. And ultimately that makes that makes everybody stronger. And I think that's what it sounds like you're trying to do there at UW-Milwaukee. So talk a little bit about when you first got the job. What were some things that, you know, obviously you had never been a head coach before, so you come in, what were some things that you thought, if we're going to build this program and get it to where I want it to be, these are some things that I have to put in place in order for the program to get to where I want it to get to? Do you remember what your first priority or two were when you first got the job?
Well, I think, you know, anytime that you get a head job, and this, obviously you talked about it, that it was my first time getting this opportunity. You know, I had a lot of great people that, you know, that I worked with that gave me a tremendous amount of advice. You know, I can talk about from the time at, you know, Lincoln to Green Bay and Loyola, Missouri State, and at Northwestern, there were tremendous people. And I would say, you know, the first thing that they talked about, and we kind of mentioned it, was getting great assistant coaches that were in alignment with what your goals are and how you want it to be and how you wanted the program to look. And, you know, so once you establish those things and you have those guys that will work hard for you and do whatever they could to get it done, you know, then you had to establish your culture and how you want it to be. But that takes time, and you have to build trust with your players and who you already have in. You know, that was going to be the most difficult thing, is, you know, you're going into a place where someone else had recruited these kids that were in there, and then they don't trust you. And it's nothing against the person who was hired in there. It's just a natural instinct of kids to wait a minute. I don't know you. I don't know what you're about. I don't know if you really care about me. So they innately don't trust you. So you have to build that trust and all of that. And then, you know, Jim Phillips, who's the AD at Northwestern, he would always tell me is it's not going to happen overnight. You have to build from, you know, the foundation. You have to start with the foundation, and you have to trust that it's going to, you know, periodically get done and in the right way. And, you know, so that's followed me. And then, you know, I had a great model of where, you know, my last stop of, and even prior to that, we built every place I've been, we've had to build, and we had to kind of bring it up from the rubble a little bit. So, you know, from that standpoint, I had a great lesson of how do you take things from the very bottom and try to build. And you don't do it by skipping steps. And I think that was the greatest lesson that anybody's ever told me. And our AD consistently, or my former AD at Northwestern, who he consistently tells me, don't skip steps, Patrick. Don't skip steps. My AD now, Amanda Braun, she says the same thing, is, you know, we're not skipping any steps. Continue to do the right thing with the things with this program, and things are going to work out. And she trusts, you know, that we are, you know, going about it the right way.
So what does that look like when you say don't skip steps? What are some steps that in your mind are things that you're trying to do, things that you've already done that are leading you to the success that you eventually want to have?
You know, I think every coach who gets in this profession, they think about winning. And so when you think about winning, you think about how can I get there as quickly as I possibly can? Because everybody's a competitor, and you want to win at all costs sometimes. But sometimes, you know, we've seen it that a lot of coaches will sacrifice themselves and sacrifice their souls for a win or for the best player in the world and all that stuff. And that's what I think, that's what it looks like. You know, the other side of that is when you're not skipping steps, you're just saying, you know what, a loss may seem like a loss to somebody else, but that, you know, maybe that loss may be a win depending upon how you played and what your goals are for each game that you go into, or each step from recruiting to the process and all that stuff. And I'll you know, sometimes, you know, in skipping steps, you'll say, you know what, in order to win, I'll get a jerk as a player, but he can play. But I almost kind of put set my program ablaze because I've tried to get the best player that's not a true fit for your program. And, you know, so I'm reminded of that constantly. It may not look pretty from the very beginning. You know, if you don't get that best player or you pass on a really good talent in order to sacrifice the culture of your team and program, but eventually it'll pay off for you. And I'm a true believer that eventually it's going to pay off for us. And skipping steps also is making sure that when you're building the right way, you're building with kids that, you know, have a, you know, singular focus of I want to do the right thing. I want to get a great education. I want to perform well. I want to do all this stuff from a basketball standpoint. And, you know, you're going to be an everyday type of person, an everyday type of team, an everyday, you know, type of program, all that stuff. So that's what it means to me. And that's what it looks like. And I think we're going about it the right way. The wins hadn't come the way that and as quickly as we wanted to. You know, it looked that way my first year when we went from, you know, the team had gone from 8 wins the previous year before I got there to 16. So I'm thinking, I know it's not easy, but we're going in the right direction.
Right.
Some say you don't want to win too early or else you create unrealistic, you know, things from that standpoint. But we had a lot of wins this year, despite, you know, some losses, you know, and people don't understand that, but our program, we do.
All right. Talk a little bit about what it takes to build the kind of culture that you want to build, and then just describe for us what the culture of your program is all about. Maybe give us some pillars, give us some words that you guys use within your program to say, hey, this is the kind of program that we are. Just talk about the culture that you're trying to build there.
Yeah, you know, I think the first part of your culture is the people that are in it. And, you know, first it starts at the top with our AD and our administration, and then it starts with our coaches. If you don't have a buy-in, if you don't have the people that really believe in what you're doing, then that's going to erode over a period of time. But I believe that we have that. You know, I think we have committed coaches. And then it comes, you know, the other part is the other people are the players. I think everybody knows this. You have to get very good kids that are committed to that are committed to everything that's involved in the program, that are committed to doing a great job academically, that don't miss classes, that don't don't get in trouble, they don't embarrass their family or friends or anyone in that university, that they're committed to working hard, they want to get their bodies right, they treat their bodies right. So from the coaches to the players, you know, you really have to be committed to that. And you have to be honest with yourself too. You know, the thing that we have to do as coaches is we have to make sure that if there aren't people and coaches or players that aren't committed to doing the right things and committed to being everyday guys, then that can't be a part of your program, because ultimately they're going to get to somebody on that, you know, on that team. And when you have one guy that isn't committed and then they infiltrate someone else's mind and all that stuff, then there's two, and then two could lead to four. And then there goes your, you know, your program and the things that you want to do the right way. You know, so that's, you know, kind of encapsulates, you know, what that looks like is it first starts with the people, you know, that you bring in. And then it just starts with, you know, from the mentality that you have with those people in there. And I want anybody looking at our program that says, you know what, that's a tough minded team, that's a tough minded program, they do things the right way. You almost have to kill them to beat them. And you know, I just want to have that tough mindset if you're looking at my team, and that's what I think that we're built on, and that's what I think our culture is. And And some people say, it's a grind. It is a grind. You know, you're going you're almost 12 months out of the year doing things and competing and getting yourself ready, you know, for the grind of however 5 or 6 month period. And, you have to enjoy the grind, you know, you have to embrace that. And, you know, if you have guys that don't embrace it, you know, then you're going to be in trouble. You know, I saw a tweet from a young man then, and I get it. You know, kids are, you know, they're anxious right now. They're trying to go through, they're going through so much. This is unusual for them. They can't, they've never gone through anything like this before, and it's still adversity. And we're trying to coach them and teach them on how to handle this and be and have a great perspective about it. But the tweet said is, this is about recruiting, all the stuff going on. I'm sick of, you know, coronavirus, which is accurate in a fact. Everybody is. I'm sick of the way that we have to do things now. And, all this, you know, phone calls and virtual stuff that and meeting with coaches, I'm sick of this crap. And from one standpoint, I look at it and say, you know what? I am too. You know what I mean?
Right.
I am
right.
too. I'd rather be in front of you and trying to help you and really let you see the campus and meet our guys and all that stuff. But then I stepped back and I said, what if I give you a scouting report, you have to play against the best team in the world or best team in your league, and you have that scouting report and you say you're sick of this. What if you miss a line and you have to run it again and then you stop running because you say you're sick of this? What if after a hard practice, you have to go into the weight room and you have to lift after that? What if after, you know, the lift and now you have to do your treatment, and then from your treatment, you have to eat, and then you have to, you know, go to study table, and then you say, I'm sick of all of this. You know, so I looked at that and said, you know what, this is not my type of kid, and could have been a good kid. Maybe he's just sick of it. But I want somebody saying, you know what, we're dealing, you know, we have to go through this. I have to embrace it for what it is, and I'm ready to attack it. I'd rather see somebody like that. And maybe I'm making a poor judgment on a kid based off of that, but, you know, it's little things like that that make me pause and realize, let's make sure you do all your homework on every single kid. I think we made the right decision.
Well, I heard you say a couple times, use the term an everyday guy. Is that a term that you use with your players? And whether you do or you don't, just define that in your mind, because I think that's something that encapsulates a lot of what many coaches want in their culture. They want everyday guys. So just talk a little bit about what that means to you.
Yeah, and I definitely will. Kind of the phrases we use are everyday guys and working until and build brick by brick. But everyday guys to me are, you know, similar to, you know, what I just talked about is you're going to have great days, you're going to have bad days, you're going to have days in between, but that doesn't change how you are. You're going to get up in the morning every single day, you're going to have a positive attitude about attacking your classes, making all your classes on time, seeing your academic advisors, being, you know, having a great spirit, coming to the weights, being ready to build your body up. It's practice. Maybe you're down in energy, but I'm going to find it some way, somehow, to be a great teammate, have a great practice, lift somebody else up. We always talk about filling somebody else's cup. We talk about afterwards of doing the right things. You know, so it's every day, and it's kind of it's not the right term, but insanity. You know, it's, and you talked about, you know, the Groundhog's Day. You gotta want to do this every single day, no matter the grind, no matter whether it's successful or, you know, there have been some setbacks. You have to want to do this every single day. And I think that the more everyday guys that you have in your program, the more success that you have. And you know, I think we're slowly getting to that point where we have a lot of everyday guys and everyday coaches too.
All right. So follow up with that. You obviously want every guy on your team, on your roster, to be an everyday guy. And yet, you know, during the season, there's going to be guys on the end of your bench who don't play as much as they want to play, or there's going to be guys who don't have the role that they want. So just talk a little bit about how you keep the guys at the back end of your roster engaged throughout the season, because I know that's something that you think about as a coach. And a lot of times as coaches, we end up spending a lot of our time with thinking about the guys who are at the end of our roster and making sure that they're engaged, that we're keeping them a part of the team. So just talk a little bit about how you go about doing that and keeping those guys at the back end of the roster engaged and keeping them as everyday guys.
Yeah, that's really tough and tricky. And, you know, the thing that I, you know, really from the very beginning is I talk about, and we had up on our board every single meeting that we have, is we have our standards and our mission statement and what that means. And the things that are on that standard board, Center of Excellence board, is trust and accountability. And so when you have guys at the end of your bench and there's no question they want to play, they want to try to help you succeed, and I hope that they're wanting to let me play hard and beat this guy out in practice so I get an opportunity, and that's what I'm looking for. But the first part of that is just the trust. Is when I talk with each and every one of them individually and as a group, I tell them the truth. I tell them where they're at, and we talk about their roles on this team based upon summer and fall. And then we talk about, you know, where we feel like their role is on our team. And I think if we talk about it from that standpoint, you start building trust with them. And I do it in front of, you know, I've talked to them about it individually, but I do our roles in front of everybody. I talk about them individually in front of everybody from where they're at, so that even the guys that may get the 30 minutes per game, they understand where this young man is at and what he's done. And I can corroborate with my best player, and he can say, yeah, I see why he's not playing. You know what I mean? And so if we can build that trust and they know that I have their best interest at heart, and that we have our open door meeting, they can come in at any point and talk. And I'm not afraid to telling our guys the truth, and they know that, and they know where I stand. Then the second part is the accountability of it, is if they're accountable, and that's where you get the everyday guys are going to be accountable for themselves. If they see on a stat sheet that they may not be producing like somebody else that's playing a lot, then there's the accountability. Like, wait a minute. This guy's produced in practice and in games, and I've had my chance, and I'm not there yet. So we had guys like that came up to me and told me that, like, coach, I want to get to where he's at. I know where I'm at right now, though. Can you work with me? Can I come in and watch film? Can we stay after practice and work on this single aspect in the game or from the practice? And so that's where kids, they start being accountable. And I thought we had that with some of our guys who were on the bench this year. And then it's the love. You know, our guys from one, we had 18 guys. We had four walk-ons. But our guys at the end of the bench, they were so ecstatic for the success of their teammates because they loved each other. So that's what kept them going, in my opinion. It wasn't anything I did or said, but because they hung out together, they were at their apartments or dorms, they did everything together. They talked about this being the best team that they've ever been a part of from that standpoint. Because they loved each other, it made them work harder, because you don't want to let that person down when you're going into practice. And our guys who were players, you know, who played a lot, they would get on our, you know, guys if they felt like, you know, those guys that were 10 through 13 or 14 on the depth chart, they would get on those guys if they didn't feel like they were bringing it. And so that's, you know, that's where I think you get to them. If you have that trust and that accountability part and that love for each other, your guys that don't play as much, you know, yeah, they want to win, they want to compete, and they want to be out there. But they'll buy in, you know, to a certain extent. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think that sounds like a fun team to coach.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, we didn't get, like I told you, we didn't have the wins, but that's why I'm telling you that I thought we won without the wins in some of our losses, because we had great teammates. They loved being around each other. And, you know, at times, though, they realized I had to step it up, and we'll tell them that. And I'll always be honest with my guys from that standpoint and be truthful. Like, yeah, he's scoring 16 for a reason. And I'm giving him, you know, the ball. I'm putting the ball in his hands for a reason, because I trust that. You know, I trust him. And I want to, you know, we had a couple guys this year that I told them in front of everybody is, I'm looking at you every single day in practice. I'm watching you two every single, I know what these guys can do. I'm watching you every single day in practice because I'm hoping that you can give us, you know, a stretch of 3 or 4 minutes of great basketball, you know, when we call your name. But if I don't see that in practice, where you're going through a, you know, anything competitive in practice, and it's a 3 or 4 minute segment, and that you don't give me, that you don't produce or give everything that you have in that 3 or 4 minute segment, then how can your teammates trust you when they come out of the game to give you that same thing, or give them that same thing?
Yeah, you have to, I think, again, it goes back to what you said about accountability and making sure that you're handling what it is that you need to do as a player. And I think oftentimes, you know, you'll hear players that will grumble about opportunities and they're not getting an opportunity in a game. And I think what players sometimes forget is that in practice, you're getting plenty of opportunities to be able to demonstrate and show what you're doing. And coaches are clearly paying attention to that in the practice setting.
And you cut off a little bit.
I think it's important for players to understand that you're being evaluated every single day, every single moment with on everything. It could be culture piece. It could be your performance on the floor. Like you said, we might only need 3 minutes from you out of this game, but that could be the difference between a win and a loss, that 3 minutes. And I got to be able to trust, just like you talked about, trust in other ways. You know, yeah, I got to be able to trust if I put you on the floor that your performance is going to live up to what we need in order for us to be successful. We're coming close here, Pat, to an hour and a half. I got one more question for you, actually a two-parter. So my last question is, when you think about your years here at UW-Milwaukee, what has been your biggest challenge in the job? And then let's end on a high note with, what's your biggest joy when you wake up every day in the morning? What's your biggest joy about being the head coach at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee?
Well, the biggest challenge is, and that's a great question, but the biggest challenge is when we develop any of our players and they're really good and they're young, and or the redshirt guys believing that their best basketball is ahead. And then kids decide that they want to transfer. You know, that's the biggest challenge, because nowadays you're not, it's almost as if you're not preparing them for their 4 years. It's almost like they're at your program. It's like you're preparing them for what could be their next stop. So if you're really doing a great job in developing kids, and that's the way it was our first year. You know, they had, you know, we had an 8+ win margin from before I got there to the year, the time I got there. And so kids are thinking, well, shoot, you know, we had more success than we did the previous year. My numbers went up and I got greater opportunities. I have this film in front of me now that I can show somebody else. And now let me go see if, you know, if I can do this at the highest level. And so in this day and age where, you know, there's a lot of transfers and for whatever reason, that's the greatest challenge of really building your program and trying to build it with those 4 year guys that you can keep and not have to worry about if they're being poached by, you know, other programs, and in particular high major programs. You know, that's it, you know, now they're talking about with the one-time transfer rule coming out, that's going to be even a greater challenge, because now if you develop them, he hasn't left yet and he's doing well in school and he's doing well in your program, he can leave at any point.
Yeah, that's crazy. It really is crazy. I mean, when you think about it from a mid-major standpoint, I mean, that rule is a potential, I would think, from a mid-major perspective, a potential disaster.
Yeah, no, it is. And that's what all of us are afraid of. And there's seemingly no control on that at this point. And we almost have to, and I believe in a kid having the right, if they're being abused or mistreated or something like that, to, you know, find a different avenue, a different place. But if there's nothing like that going on, and a kid just wants to leave just because they, you know, score 15 points per game for you and they have 2 years of eligibility, you know, there's nothing then that we're going to be able to do. You know, we can't control that. So that's a challenge. And then the greatest joy is just when I wake up every single day knowing that there's a great opportunity in front of us to, you know, to get our guys better, to you know, get with my staff and talk about our strategies, how we move forward with our team, with recruiting. All of that just gives me so much joy. And then I always think to where we can be, you know, so when March hits next year, will we be in a position where we can say, you know, we're either dancing, winning our league, or getting, you know, have to, you know, what do we need to do to continuously improve? That just brings me joy. And then the ultimate joy is the guys that you coach and that you mentor, that you see them graduate. And that's our role as a coach is, our role, and we need to win. We want to win. But we're trying to help young men go from whatever time we get them, from 18 to, you know, 23 or 24 years of age. Our role is to make sure that they grow up, they become, you know, quality young men, and that they graduate and, you know, be able to do something with their degree and be impactful in their lives.
Pat, that is fantastic stuff. It's been a pleasure getting a chance to talk to you this morning for almost an hour and a half. Before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share where people can connect with you and connect with your program. Give them a way to find out more about what you have going at UW-Milwaukee, and then I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate you allowing me to get on with you and had a great time. If you want to connect with me, and if you have any questions or anything pertaining to my program, you know, my email address is baldwinp@uwm.edu. And I'm constantly, you know, on Twitter as well, probably to the detriment of my family. But my Twitter account is @CoachBaldwin23. And, you know, I'm constantly looking at that stuff. But that's a way that you connect as well. And then our website is mkepanthers.com. And if you want to find out anything that's going on within our program. So, but I'm extremely grateful for the opportunity to come on with you and you know, share this hour and a half and talk hoops. There's nothing greater than that.
Couldn't agree more. Pat, can't thank you enough for spending the time with us this morning. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Registration is now open at headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps for boys and girls in grades 1 through 6 throughout the greater Cleveland area. Get registered today and make sure you hit the courts with us this summer.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us, so we've partnered with ProSkills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their Ultimate Shooting Guide and Video Program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be.
with 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.